Baptist 21 is a pastor-led voice for Southern Baptists in the 21st century. The B21 podcast will discuss current issues in the SBC with Southern Baptist church leaders. To check out more resources, visit us at baptist21.com.
Welcome to the Baptist 21 podcast. On the Baptist 21 podcast, we want to have conversations about what it means to be Baptist in the 21st century. And today on the podcast, I have with me Dr. Albert Moeller, president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Dr. Moeller is also a family friend. And a nice anecdote, he once bailed my twin brother and I out of jail. And so he's a dear friend to us. Dr. Moeller, thank you for taking time to be on the podcast.
Well, Nathan, I can just tell you, it's always good to be with you. Thank you.
So there's a fun story in the past where Dr. Moeller and my dad, Danny Aiken, came to pick Jonathan Aiken and I up. We weren't really being that scandalous, but we have been bailed out of a police station.
You were caught in a city park after dusk.
I mean, it's just scandalous. So. Well, Dr. Moeller, we want to discuss your new book, The Gathering Storm, Secularism, Culture, and the Church. And I think it actually releases today as we're recording. Is that right?
That's right. It's released June the 2nd, the very day we're having this conversation.
So, Dr. Moeller, you borrow this title from Volume 1 of Churchill's six-volume history of World War II. Why did you pick the title, and in what ways would you say the times are comparable to then, and what ways are they kind of different?
Yeah, it's always kind of a dangerous thing to look at any particular historic moment and say, that's what I'm thinking about now. For me and for Churchill, it's been an ongoing conversation, as you well know, for about 40-something years. And it's not an accident that there are actually two oral portraits of Churchill in my library and hundreds of books by and about him. Elton Trueblood, the Quaker theologian, said every young man, and it's not just about young men, but that's to whom he was speaking. He said, needs a perpetual vision of greatness. You need people with whom you have ongoing conversations from history. And most of those are theological for me. But one of them is Churchill. And one of the great puzzlements about Winston Churchill is how he could see things that others were looking at but wouldn't see, especially during the time of the 1930s. And so looking back after the war, he talked about the wasted decade of the 1930s in Europe when Hitler could have been stopped at so much more easily and at less horrifying costs of life than actually happened in World War II. And he just talked about the threats as they gathered and talked about the gathering storm. And it's the metaphor. So I do not mean that America or the world in 2020 is America on the brink of the Second World War. We're not facing the same kind of threat as was Adolf Hitler. But it's the metaphor that Churchill used there that's always captured my attention. And that is that we know what it's like on a summer afternoon to watch a storm build. And you know that it's coming. And we're having our own season of storms, and I just hope to connect some of the dots, to talk a bit about what storm is gathering and what it means.
So you are president of a seminary. You lead leaders all the time. But what is the audience for this book?
I would say reading Christians. Christians who read books and want to think and understand the culture, understand the times. And, you know, no book can be comprehensive in doing that. So long ago, I kind of surrendered the idea that I could write a book that would be comprehensive. So in the many books I've written, I've tried to take a piece of the situation and say, I hope this is helpful. You know, if you read this, I hope you'll understand the world better, understand the gospel better, understand our Christian responsibility better. And so the issues that I address are really very tightly addressed to the season in which we're living.
Good. So it's very clear from the metaphor and even the book, the gathering storm is secularism. So maybe give us a little bit about what you mean by that term, and then what are the concerning things that are seeming to coalesce in order for this storm to gather?
Yeah, you know, a publisher decides on a lot of things about a book, including the subtitle there. I didn't disagree with it, but secularism, as I talk about in the book, is an ideology. The bigger context is secularization, and secularization is the process of a society becoming less theistic and more secular in the way it thinks, acts, laughs, intuits, and so that's the bigger issue. But But that's a word that doesn't communicate well to the American people. They understand secularism more clearly. So it's really saying that, look, the most fundamental issue that's going on right now is that theism and the cultural structures that have been influenced by theism are now being confronted with people who have vast influence in society and increasing numbers of people just, you know, getting on the subway and, you know, jumping in an Uber car, whose worldviews are actually pervasively secular. Now, as a Christian theologian, especially as someone from the Reformed tradition, I don't believe that anyone is actually as secular as he or she thinks. But the bigger problem are the people who don't even think themselves secular, but their worldview is becoming increasingly that way.
Yeah. What would you say are the biggest threats that we kind of face as Christians right now that are in this kind of vein of secularism that we face in 2020 America?
Yeah, you know, the word threat is not wrong, especially when you just put out a book with storm clouds on the cover. But I would prefer to say challenges. So, in other words, threats, I want to depersonalize this as much as possible and say, you know, the challenges we face are this. Most Christians, and, you know, I'm 60 years of age, and yet I would take this down, say, another 30 years. Most of the people who are somewhere between 30 and 60, and everyone who's older, grew up in an America where at least the part of America that we lived in, and by that I mean theologically and culturally more than geographically, there was still a powerful presence of Christianity in the culture. And yet, if you're 30 or younger, you've actually never known that society. And so there's a great challenge where I think most Christians don't recognize that millions of people around us actually don't think as we think much at all. Now, there's a lot of shared humanity by common grace. I'm thankful for that. But when we think about truth, fact, morality, right and wrong, it's not that we have various areas of disagreement. It's increasingly that the patterns of thinking are really distant and growing more distant.
You know, you'll have some Christians say that the goal shouldn't be to have a Christian government. We're certainly not pressing for a theocracy. We're not a Christian nation. That shouldn't be that big a deal. We should just simply live Christian lives, preach the gospel, be members of our churches, and affect the culture that way. How would you kind of respond to that kind of statement?
Well, I would say it's a limited understanding of love of neighbor. We believe that God has given culture, civilization, society, government to us by common grace because he loves us and shows his glory in the right ordering of human beings. And let me state very clearly, I am not calling for an imposition of Christian morality in law the way that Reconstructionist, Dominionist, or others have said, you know, in terms of, you know, making biblical law simply a secular law or government law. I am saying that Western civilization as a project was influenced by Christianity, by Christian morality, Christian understanding of truth, and yes, Christian theistic claims in such a way that even our understanding of human rights and human dignity are rooted in Christianity. You cut off Christianity. And by the way, you'll notice that in our increasingly secular society, you don't just have the rejection of a Christian understanding of human dignity, you have a denial of a natural rights, you know, grounding of human dignity. And that means that there is no grounding of human dignity, which is why, you know, and everything's now just politics. That's a disaster. Western civilization can't survive the denial of human beings as human beings. And that's going to come from Christianity. And so, I, you know, the fact is that I had someone respond to the book this morning in print and say, you know, Mohler's saying that that Western liberalism can't survive without a commitment to Christianity or the influence of Christianity. And I'm saying, yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying, but it's the latter. It's the influence of Christianity. This means that love of neighbor means that we really want divorce law to be ordered in such a way that marriage is upheld and we don't make it easy for people to escape the responsibility to their spouse and children. We want the taking of human life to be illegal, enforced by the state. And we mean that when we're talking about homicide, when we're talking about George Floyd and what's now defined as third-degree homicide in Minneapolis, and to the tragic awareness of the entire world. And we also mean that in the womb. You know, and again, that's law. And so the Christians who say all we should do is preach the gospel and just be faithful in our churches and hope for the effect on society, that really flies in the face of a Christian responsibility to seek an ordering of the civil order that that will lead to human peace and happiness. And so I had someone tell me, look, we shouldn't expect any kind of Christian responsibility. We shouldn't concede any Christian responsibility when it comes to politics. We have absolutely nothing to do with the political order. Excuse me, I've got to go to the pro-life rally. That's just inconsistent, you know. And by the way, we think of abortion as a human dignity issue, which means a human rights issue and a human justice issue and a righteousness issue. We as Christians are the ones who understand those things can never be severed from one another.
So you don't get to pick really kind of when a book comes out. You would have never been able to guess the moment that we'd be facing right now as this book releases on June 2nd. We are in the midst of a storm. We've come out of a yeah. pandemic. And then now you've mentioned George Floyd, and we have protests, some peaceful, and then you have riots and looting, all kinds of stuff. Maybe I'll ask a question like this. Do you think the current storms we're in, or at least aspects of what are being portrayed in these storms, is connected to what you write in this book? And how would you kind of make sense of all this for the listeners?
Well, you know, when you write a book like this and coming out from a major publisher, it's on a timetable. And the timetable is seasonal in the book business, so to speak. So you've got, you know, winter releases, Christmas releases, summer releases. This is a summer release. And look, it's timed partly because people in 2020 are going to be thinking about some of these issues. Part of the reason why I wrote the book when I did, but it also means it was finished months ago. And it was finished so many months ago that no one knew what COVID-19 meant. No one had heard of it. And so there's a storm that's not in my book, The Gathering Storm. And then you have what has taken place on the streets of America and the aftermath of events of tension, such as I mentioned George Floyd, but other things that already existed. And so none of that was seen. But you asked the question, is there any relevance, you know, even to those issues? And I would say yes, especially not so much COVID-19. Although even there you do see confusion over religious liberty issue. You have Christians certain that any restriction on, you know, human autonomous liberties and infraction of religious liberty. And then you have others such as governors in several states who evidently don't know when they are violating religious liberty. So that's a major concern in the book. But I think jumping from COVID-19, it's the chaos in the streets that's a far more apparent tie. And that is the fact that when human beings look at that picture of George Floyd, and that knee on the back of his neck, we know it's wrong. The question is, why is it wrong? And this is where seculars say it's wrong because it's wrong. It's wrong because it's in a structure of oppression and, it's just wrong. Well, why is it wrong? Because it's wrong. This is where Christians say, oh, it's wrong for a far deeper meaning than that. It's because George Floyd was made by the one sovereign creator God for his glory and made in his image. He bears the full dignity of an image bearer of God. He was treated there as someone who is not a full image bearer. And thus this act was an assault not only, and that's by the way, the entire idea of homicide in the Bible, which again, let's be thankful, continues in the American and in the Western legal consciousness. The idea of homicide is the killing of a human being is wrong because it is the slaying of an image bearer. And even to act with depraved indifference to the value of human life in that sense is horrifying. So it's in a situation like this, we're not less distressed than the world. We're more distressed than the world. This is an assault not only on a man or a community. It's an assault upon the image of God.
Let's talk about the religious liberty case that just came to the Supreme Court. I mean, that has some bearing on things you write in the book as well. How concerning is the decision, and, you know, what do you think the ramifications will be going forward?
Well, let's just say that at this point, it's not a major decision. The court actually decided by a 5-4 vote not to grant a preliminary injunction in a case from California, another case from Illinois. So there's not a major precedential value that comes in that kind of action by the court. But nonetheless, it's troubling. I talked about it on the briefing. Chief Justice siding with the more liberal bloc, you know, on the court. It just goes to show, by the way, that an issue like religious liberty is incredibly contextual. And so it's also clear that the Chief Justice said the context of COVID-19 and the legitimate government effort to try to limit the spread of the pandemic puts us in an unusual situation. And so in one sense, we may look back and say that action had very little consequence at all. Or we might look back and say, you know, what happens during a pandemic just doesn't stop when the pandemic's over. So I hate to say this, but in honesty, we'll have to say time will tell.
Yeah. So because of the way, I mean, this is just showing my ignorance, even though I studied political science. So the way the decision was made, it's not going to be something that could be used in the future to say, well, governors at times have the discretion to say when and how churches can meet.
No. And in his majority statement, the Chief Justice actually said, based upon, additional claims, the plaintiffs can come back and make an additional appeal, even for immediate relief by a preliminary injunction. So this was not a case. There's not going to be a case, you know, that's going to show up in the history of the Supreme Court as, X versus Y that people are going to cite, like Roe v. Wade or Plessy versus Ferguson. You know, you just go down the list of cases that we talk about, Marbury versus Madison. That's not going to be the case. But you often find out, in fact, especially when it comes to this kind of decision, we often find out the decisions we didn't think were so major turn out to have a long-term effect.
Hugh, let's turn from the kind of government to the church. You write in the book that these forces have invaded the church. There's a whole chapter on this. How have they invaded the church? And maybe I just want to ask this question as a historian. Is this common in every age of the church, kind of, have these threats, these challenges, and they, you know, in some ways compromise? And is this common, or is this kind of unique to the American experience?
I think it's a very good question, Nathan, first of all. But, you know, as a historical theologian, I have to say, looking at history of the church, I've never actually seen a time in which just about everyone in the church said, you know, everything's just right. So there have always been challenges. And so, I was looking at some documents from 17th century Puritanism in England the other night. And, you know, it's just amazing how dire they understood the situation to be in England in the 17th century. And I look back at it and say, you know, you guys were right. But it robs us of thinking there was ever a golden moment when everything was just right. Someone pointed out and said, well, at least you can point to a golden moment like the Reformation. Well, hey, I ground a lot of my identity in the Reformation. But remember, Luther was under a death sentence. The Reformation was an argument.
Right.
And so, you know, again, the reformers were making charges against the Catholic Church. And the reformers be the first to say this was not a placid era in which we saw no problems. If there were no problems, it wouldn't have been a Reformation. So all that to say that, yeah, I think this is an ongoing issue. And I think you have to have two views. For one thing, we probably understand the Reformation better than Luther did, because we can look back and see things, you know, in a long historical perspective. People,
right,
if the Lord tarries, are probably going to understand our times better than we do. But we have to understand the times we're living, because by definition, that's all we've got. And so what I'm looking at are such things as, especially when it comes to the LGBTQ issues, I just see an increasing confusion and an increase in uncertainty on the part of many Christians as to how to respond to these issues. And then I see some really bad ideas being brought forth. I spend a lot of time in the book dealing with the Revoice Conference and things like that, where, I realize you wouldn't hear anything like that in evangelical circles 10 years ago. And now, you know, it's presented, right, at least by some who would claim to be evangelical.
Now would be a good time to tell you about our sponsor for the Baptist 21 podcast, the Pillar Network. If you're a pastor interested in leading your church to partner with a community of like-minded SBC churches that are doctrinally aligned, missionally driven, and committed to fulfilling the Great Commission by equipping the next generation of pastors to both plant and revitalize churches, then consider joining the Pillar Network. You can find out more information at thepillarnetwork.com. That's thepillarnetwork.com.
So I still want to talk some about the church. It seems to me one of the most divisive things right now, and you even mentioned kind of the politicization of everything. One of the biggest divisions in the church right now is politics. You as a leader take heat on some things you've said. What kind of words of counsel would you have for Christians as far as how we should approach, view politics in a way that hopefully does maintain this, you know, unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace while having real disagreement?
Well, Nathan, to your utter frustration, I'm not sure I have any words of counsel. I say that tongue in cheek. I would say that the most difficult issue for a lot of Christians right now is knowing where there are absolute lines that must be drawn and where there are issues of judgment in which grace and respect should prevail. Mutual grace, mutual respect. And I've said I believe it's the Christian responsibility to try to uphold the dignity and sanctity of human life. And so without apology, abortion is a major issue. No one actually is a single-issue voter. We all have single issues where we will say, well, that's an indication of a larger problem, and that has to inform my vote in a determinative way. But as Christians, we don't believe there are any single issues. They're all tied together. And we also believe that in the fallen world, politics is never perfect, and there's not a perfect political party. There's not a perfect political candidate. And yet there are the more and less perfect, I should say the more obviously imperfect. That'd be a better theological statement. And our political options are more and more obviously imperfect. And so we have prudence, but you know, there are also patterns. So if you look at politics in America today, it is interesting that political scientists will say the most powerful indicator of a vote may well come down to whether or not that individual attended any church on the Sunday prior to the election. It's just a sign that there's a very clear secular divide, even in American politics. So there's that pattern's huge. But amongst believers, I think we are doing a really bad job of saying, look, this is where we have to stand together, and this is where we may make different electoral decisions, and without claiming we agree with one another, we can say in respect and consideration, this is where we may disagree, but this is not a church discipline issue. This is not a unity of the church issue. Now, obviously, you can't say that about every political issue. You know, in other words, there are some non-negotiables. There are some boundary lines. Yet it's not clear that we're thinking very well about that right now.
In the book, you also have a chapter called The Gathering Generational Storm. You kind of highlight an attitude of individualism, this kind of what is good for you is good for you. But what are some other aspects of this gathering storm? And then I want to ask this a personal question as a new parent. Kind of give me a snapshot of what you say in the book as far as how to prepare my child for this coming storm.
Yeah, you know, it's very, very interesting because I have been in ministry and in leadership in the evangelical world in the Southern Baptist Convention for a long time, and there's something new. And I'm at least old enough to say this is new, Nathan, and that is that I'm confronting the first generation of Christian parents and grandparents who say, when I look at my children and grandchildren, I'm noticing a clearer generational line than even the secular believer divide, or, you know, you could just go down the list. And so people are going to say, well, what about the hippies in the 60s and, you know, the teenage rebellion and all the rest? That's a different picture. What we're talking about now is that something has shifted in our culture in the way the engines of cultural production work and the way higher education and secondary education works and the way the media and all that works, to where we have young people largely in. So let me get a chase to the bottom line. The old narrative that seemed to work was young people are distant from their parents until they become them. You know, and so you know, you have the radicals of the 60s who, you know, within 15 years are the tenured professors at, you know, Ohio State. So that's and they've got 401ks and, you know, house in the suburbs. They got sprinklers, you know, on the lawn out front. So, you know, they define themselves against their parents and then they become them. Well, something's changed. And it's changed in really interesting ways in that second part's just not happening. And so just to be clear, it's showing up in things like we used to say that people lived kind of a reckless youth and then they settled down and got married. They're not. And then the experience of having children, you know, helps to domesticate adults and gives them responsibility. Well, what happens when they don't? And so we're looking at patterns. And so this is something that can't be quickly fixed or reversed either because it makes a difference if you get married at, say, 24 or you don't get married at all or you get married at 49. It's a different life experience. And so, there's some huge issues out there. And, you know, there's where evangelical church is, Nathan. You and I live in a world in which, you know, that people have often assumed that, yes, you know, we tend to lose young people by some percentage when they graduate from high school, but they tend to come back so somewhere around 26, 27, 28. They settle down, you know, they get married, and they tend to come back to church. That is profoundly not happening. It's profoundly not happening. And so, you know, in the Southern Baptist Convention, we're looking at baptism numbers, we're looking at attendance figures, looking at other things. But the same thing is happening outside the church. Let me put it this way. I don't think there are many young men joining the Elks Club. There probably haven't been for a very, very long time. But, someone like a Daniel Patrick Moynihan or someone would come back and say, you know, well, that's important because those associations help to build society. Yeah, that's true. But I'm concerned about the church. And that's a very different thing. And so, you know, when I talk about generational storm, I don't mean to say, hey, there's something wrong with young people. I mean to say, look, something's happening here, and we better pay some real close attention to it.
Another chapter you have is The Gathering Storm and Engines of Culture. You talk about Silicon Valley and social capital. Yep. This could be its own podcast, so I don't necessarily want you to go full into this, but could you just speak to the kind of the good, bad, and ugly of social media, and how does it play a part in kind of the cultural storm? And then how do you anticipate it'll be used moving forward?
Yeah, there's so much there. You know, what I'm feeling right now on June the 2nd of 2020 is the negativity of social media that's just clamoring in order to gain attention and cause division. Now, at the same time, there are important facts and arguments that are being made in social media, but I'm finding it very, very difficult to filter, you know, because I can't even follow it all. Look, I'm thankful that video of George Floyd went viral because that's the power of social media. You didn't have to wait for a newspaper editor or anything. There it was. It's there for people to see. But that very same technology means that someone could put up something that's not true. And it can travel around the world. And people feel free, liberated for the first time in human history, to say things that destroy trust and destroy respect, a culture of denunciation. You know, if you don't quickly denounce X or Y, then you're on the wrong side of humanity. Well, you may not even know about X or Y yet, you know. Here's something we know about social media we did not know 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. And that is that most of the action is driven by people, a limited number of people who invest a great deal of energy in it. And, you know, if you're a mom taking care of, you know, little kids, you're a parent, you know, trying to take care of your family. If you're at work, actually doing work, if you try to lead anything, then you don't have time to follow all this. And the next thing you know, you've been written on the wrong side of history. You know, and by people who don't have any stake in this other than saying that. And, you know, there are other things that social media rewards and that are very unhealthy. And one of them is just instantaneous thinking, which means, you know, again, I've been in public life for 40 years. And, you know, people can go back and see what I said 40 years ago and bring it forward. And I feel responsibility about that. But on social media, there are people who, you know, say this at 9:05 and say something else at 9:11 with no particular need to even have a constant message or even be, you know, non-contradictory. Everything's instantaneous and in the moment. It's kind of Nietzschean, you know, in that way. And the other really sad thing is how many people let their mood, their self-esteem, their attitudes just ebb and flow on the basis of social media. If I did that, I would be absolutely neurotic. I know that's an outdated word, but I would be nonetheless, outdated or not. You know, every technology, and Jacques Ellul, the great thinker, Christian thinker and philosopher about technology in the 20th century, made the point that technology is never neutral. And the larger its effect, the larger its moral meaning. And yet you can't put a genie back in the bottle, so to speak. Pandora's box is open. And Neil Postman in the 1990s made the very same point in his book Technopoly, you know, that technology is never value neutral. But once it's there, you don't know the moral importance of it and the impact of it until it's too late. So in Silicon Valley, by the way, as I point out, Silicon Valley understood this before the rest of the world. You had like organizations like Facebook making basically, you know, great commission statements about the purpose of their technology, you know, in their own messianic vision to unite all of humanity in one great conversation. You know, did Facebook unite a lot of human beings? Well, in one sense, connected them. But you know what? I think disunity has probably been the more graphic net effect at times. So and now you've got the Silicon Valley giants who said, we're not publishers, we're merely, you know, conduits of information. Well, they're now acting like publishers. You know, which is it? They don't know. We don't know. But, you know, it's just a point about technology. It's like the atomic bomb. We can argue about whether or not it ever should have been invented. The problem is we're on the wrong side of history to ask that question. Now it's there. And that, even though, you know, you could even have Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev talk about ridding the world of all nuclear weapons. But you know what? Nuclear weapons are still there in a blueprint, even if they're not hiding in a missile silo. Isn't that a horrible indictment of human sinfulness?
Yeah. You said a couple of things. I want to make just some statements, observations. I've read recently that 20% of Twitter users tweet 80% of the time, are doing 80% of the actual volume that goes out there. And so that tells you a lot. And then even a lot of Americans are not even on Twitter. So sometimes Twitter is definitely an echo chamber. I sometimes even now look when I see somebody being critical, I look to see how many times they've tweeted in the last hour. And usually it seems like their only job is to be on social media.
Right. And I don't ever get into Twitter fights. Yeah. I try to be very restrained, and I'm president of an institution. You know, I can't afford to be reckless. I look at some responses and I go, wow, I want to hit that back. That's untrue. That's unfair. That's unfactual. But I just can't do that. And then oftentimes I look at it and, you know, it's got the person saying this outrageous thing has got 6 followers.
Right. And tweeted 15 times in the last 20 minutes.
Right. And that's a very good point. And I it would be irresponsible of me to speak back. And furthermore, I've often got a choice. You know, I can either do my job or I can pay attention to that. It's very difficult to do both.
Yeah. And I just, as a word of encouragement to people listening who sometimes get frustrated with people like my dad, people like yourself who think y'all have got to respond to everything immediately. Sometimes I wanted to say, one, Dr. Moeller and Danny Akin, they don't need defending from me, but they handle things off of Twitter. They don't handle things on Twitter. And so they're actually addressing things. They're just doing so in a way that's different than you think is appropriate.
Yeah. And I want to say, I appreciate that word. And look, we're both fallible. That's for sure. But I want to say what I often do, I mean, all day, is get on the phone and call someone in order to solve a problem.
Right.
I can do that or I can tweet at them, but tweeting at them doesn't solve the problem. It may make that problem much worse. So, you know, you have to decide what kind of influence you want. The influence I want is someone saying, I'm going to take this phone call and I'm going to have this conversation. And, you know, I can just tell you that the greatest indictment of the Twitter culture, the whole culture, is you can't possibly get married that way. You can't possibly stay married that way. You know, if a husband and wife have a disagreement and they go back, you know, to two corners of the house and start tweeting with the world watching at each other, I think every one of us would say, I think the Freudian psychotherapist and psychoanalyst, and I think the Jungian, you know, therapist and the secular guidance counselor and the Christian pastor would all say the same thing. That's not going to solve your problem. You'd think that'd be obvious.
Right. Yeah, that's good. Do one more comment. I just got done, and I'd be curious as it plays into to your book and just even the Gathering Storm. I just got done listening to a book on Columbine, and what was interesting to me was how quickly the media got almost everything wrong, but the sensational one out. And one of the things I just, as I've been listening to it, that just seems to be echoing in my mind is we have moved from where hits get you more popularity and right. hits get you more money. And so we value sensationalism above facts. And I just feel like we're reaping the whirlwind right. of that. How do we, you said we can't put the genie back in the bottle. So what is the hope moving forward?
You know, time again is going to prove this right or wrong, but there are technologies that have outrun themselves. And I think Twitter is really close to doing that. I think Twitter is close to becoming so toxic that people just start dumping who they follow and what they pay attention to or how they look at it. And you know, I just think at some point human nature means you get worn down by this and you think, I just can't do it anymore. So I hear people saying they're taking social media sabbaticals and all this. And I mean, there are more increasingly influential people I see who just drop off of it altogether.
Yeah, I've already done it for the most part. I've got a couple groups, sports, some other things I like to look at, and people I feel like refresh me. Other than that, I've pretty much, but then you still have people text you a tweet, say, did you see this? And I'm thinking, nope, I meant not to see that. So thinking through all this, obviously, I just want to ask it like this. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future?
Yeah, you know, that's a question I get asked all the time, and I refuse to answer it. Because optimism and pessimism are both non-Christian.
Hmm.
Neither one's compatible with the gospel. Optimism is an inflated hope in human ability, and it's presumptuous. Pessimism is also presumptuous and denies the providence of God. And so I don't mean to chastise you asking the question.
No,
it's a legitimate question. I'm just reframing it. And I'm not original in this. I think basically this is very Augustinian. I'd like to think very Pauline. I think the right attitude for a Christian is neither optimism or pessimism, but hope.
Yeah.
Because hope has a name, and that name is Jesus Christ.
Mm.
And if Jesus Christ is Lord, then we can't be pessimists. We also can't be optimists. But hope is certain and secure and very New Testament. And so I'm gonna hang in to hope, but that hope means that I waver between what the world would call optimism and pessimism, and I waver in this sense. When I look at certain patterns, I think there's no rescue. When I look at certain beautiful realities, I think, what a wonderful world. And you know, you're a new dad. So guess what? You've got all kinds of hope. And you're going to waver, you're going to discover between optimism and pessimism about the world of the future. But you've got hope because you believe in Christ. And that means you do what a dad, Christian dad, does. And you just trust Christ.
We want to thank Dr. Moeller for being on the podcast. We recorded this 2 weeks ago on the day his book was releasing. Make sure to pick up his new book that helps us think through the storm gathering around us, which seems all the more important given the recent SCOTUS decision. You can find more information on how to order the book at Baptist21.com, and you can hear more from Dr. Moeller on this topic and others on his podcast, The Briefing. Thanks for listening to the Baptist 21 podcast.